This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Deadlands, a novel written by Benjamin Percy, read by Halter Graham. For Lisa. Part 1. All stories are in conversation with other stories. Neil Gaiman. Prologue. She knows there is something wrong with the baby. She has known from the very beginning. First there was the nausea that left her bedridden for weeks, dizzy and barely able to eat, chewing on cucumbers, filling up on spring water. Then the surges in temper, the blackening headaches. And finally, a stillness inside her, when there should have been movement, a fluttering, like the tail of a trout. That's what her friends told her. So that she would twist her body and prod her belly until the child readjusted itself, assuring her it was there. It was alive. They live in a windowless cabin high in the mountains. Others live not far away, some near a spring-fed stream, others cut back in the woods. Together they form a village of sorts, happily isolated, wary of outsiders and change, fearful of the stories told by their elders, stories of an illness that causes a bloody cough and blistering fevers, stories of missiles raining from the sky and cratering the earth, stories of scavengers with meaty breath and teeth filed into points. Outside, the snow is knee-deep. Before long, it will be taller than her husband, taller than the cabin, and every day they will need to shovel a wide passage from their door in case they should be trapped, shrouded. Sometimes she dreams the child is not a child. It is a grub, fat and white and segmented with black eyes. It is a beast with tiny yellow fangs and tiny yellow claws, its body covered in fur as sleek as an otter's. Or maybe it is a nothing, a dark spirit, a possessed vapor, and her body, the house it haunts. So she is relieved when she gives the final push and feels a tear, a gush, an emptying. And then the midwife smiles and coos and says, "There now." She cuts the cord with a knife. She carries the child to the table and wipes it clean with a rag. Juliana bunches towels between her legs and watches the child through heavy-lidded eyes. Everything is fine. Everything will turn out all right, after all. She is, as her mother always said, a worrier. Then she notices something. The absence of something. The baby is not crying. The baby has not made a sound. The midwife stands over it, the red rag in her hand like a crushed rose. "What's the matter? Is it alive? It's alive, isn't it?" The midwife nods. "Is it all right?" The midwife looks at her, looks at the baby, with a mouth that quivers with words she cannot express. "What is it, a boy?"
"A girl."
"What's wrong?" Her voice comes out, a choked whisper, when she says, "Her eyes." She drapes a blanket around the child and hurries to the bed in a rush to be rid of it. Juliana accepts the child and tears away the wrappings. Her face, splotchy and wrinkled and coned from birth, looks like any baby's face. But her eyes, they are wide open, seemingly lidless, with no whiteness to them, all pupil, no iris, as if splashed full of ink. The midwife says they will worry about it later. For now, the child must eat. The midwife thumbs down the baby's chin and plays its mouth along her nipple while Juliana massages her breast and brings from it a thick yellowish bead of colostrum. The baby nods toward the taste, but will not latch on. She keeps pulling away to stare at Juliana. It may be a trick of the light, the cabin so dim, but the baby's large eyes appear somehow sorrowful. Juliana struggles to hold the baby's head in place. She does not believe the baby should be strong enough to do so, but she is, arching her back and twisting her head to study Juliana's face. Robert cannot take the sound of her screams, or the sight of his wife writhing, naked, in pain. He tries to help at first, packing snowballs to rub along her wrists and ankles and forehead, but he cannot stop staring at her belly, which seems somehow separate from her, the skin so tight it appears ready to split, almost purple in color, with a white line running down its middle. He thinks he sees shapes in it, what look like hands, a face pressing against the skin, the baby trying to claw or chew its way out. So he pulls on his boots and doeskin jacket and escapes outside. Snow falls and accumulates on his shoulders when he paces. He is a simple man who pleasures in small things, the song of a nuthatch, the last flare of sunlight on the horizon before night rushes in, the taste of rare lamb and oak-aged whiskey. His wife confuses him. She is a woman of many moods, rarely steady in her feeling, weeping when she says she loves him and draws him into a hug, weeping when she laments him and hurls a dish at the wall. He has learned when her anger spikes, not to say anything. Not saying anything is the best medicine for their marriage, and making himself scarce. After one of her spells, that's what she calls them, as if they were dark magic, he might chop wood, or weed their garden, or wander around the bend to his nearest neighbor, Coulson, for a game of cards or dice. He hears another cry from inside, the loudest yet, and the worst sound imaginable, like an animal dying, falling from a cliff or rent in half by an axe, and he can only hope that the baby is here, that this is the end. The snow is thick, and his mind distracted. So he does not look east, where through the falling snow he might notice a faint orange glow, his neighbor's cabin, burning. And when he paces, the snow creaks beneath his boots, so he does not hear the hushed passage of the two men clambering up the hill toward him. They appear as beasts, robed in bearskins, the hollowed heads of which rest atop their own, the snouts like toothed visors that throw a shadow over their faces. They run a few paces, their boots splashing up snow, and then crouch down. Run, and then crouch. In this way they progress up the hillside, threading through trees, trampling icy bushes, plunging over frosted logs. Then they duck down and scuttle close, and lift their heads slowly over a lip of snow to observe him pacing and muttering. And then, with a white, sparkling explosion, they rush forward. At first, they try to wrestle him down, shoving him, trying to kick out his legs, but he puts up enough of a fight that they stop trying and jab a knife into his stomach, and then drag it across his neck. They hold him down in the snow until he bleeds out into a red, slushy puddle, until his body stops struggling. When the door first crashes inward, Juliana is fatigued enough by the labor and distracted enough by the child that she does not scream. She only thinks, how strange, a bear. Hurrying out of the night and into the cabin, shaggy and caked with snow and thudding across the floorboards. It pauses near the fire, the snow melting in the heat, steaming off its fur, and only then does she see the bearded man beneath the skins, the light brightening his eyes into orange coals. In one hand, he grips a knife. Its metal is bloodied, a red patina with ice crystals flowering from it. The midwife edges her way along the far wall and tries to dart past him, and he lets her. But just before she reaches the doorway, another bear-suited man steps through and seizes her and drags her into the night, her screams muffled by the snow. The first man starts toward Juliana. She is naked. She is physically ruined. She is beyond exhausted after 8 hours of contractions, 2 hours of hard labor. But still, she tries to fight him. She nestles the baby into a blanket on the bed, then lurches her body to the edge of the mattress, reaching for the rifle her husband keeps there. The man dulls her with a fist to the temple. A momentary hush falls over the world, and her vision narrows. She notices the lantern flickering on her night table. She notices a knot like an eye peering down from one of the ceiling's crossbeams. She notices the skis and poles hanging from the wall, the wedding afghan, her oma knitted, draped over a rocking chair. Then the world widens and comes crashing into motion again, and she realizes she is no longer in her bed. The man is dragging her across the floor, toward the door, his hand a crushing manacle around her wrist. She cannot walk, though she tries. Her legs stumble and collapse beneath her, her knees thud the grooves, her feet needle with splinters, her belly feels carved out by a hot spoon, but the anger boiling inside her gives her strength. She cries out and throws back her body, battling his grip. He strikes her again, knocking the last bit of willfulness from her body, and then mummies her in a blanket and hefts her over his shoulder. She does not scream, "My baby," though she knows she ought to. She only looks back to the bed, where the child lies in a nest of blankets, stained with her blood and embryonic fluid, watching her curiously, with eyes as black as the night that soon envelops her. Chapter 1. The wall is a constant in Simon's life. Everywhere he looks, impossible to miss. Yet it is as common as dust, as heat, as the sun's blazing path across the sky. And it is easy to go days, weeks, without noticing it. It is of uneven height, but at its tallest point reaches 100 feet from the ground. In some places, it is made from plaster and mortared stone, and in others, heaps of metal. The many-colored cars of another time, crushed and welded together into massive bricks that bleed rust when it rains. There are those who guard the wall, who every day climb ropes and rebar ladders to position themselves as sentries upon its flat top, wide enough for 10 men to walk abreast. They carry knives at their sides and bows on their backs. They wear wide-rimmed brown hats. Their skin is sunburned and sand-scoured, and their eyes pale and pocketed from the dark glassed goggles they wear while staring into the wastes surrounding them. From the ground they appear specks, no bigger than birds. There is life inside the wall. There is death outside the wall. That is what they, the citizens of the sanctuary, have been told over the 150 years since it was erected. Here, in what was once downtown St. Louis, they have laws, elections, currency, farms, wells, markets, a hospital, a prison, even a museum that offers the vestiges of the lost world. But outside, in the deadlands, in the sun-washed, sandy reaches of the desert, among the dried wigs of sagebrush, the pines that twist upward like tormented souls, the sunken grocery stores and corroded gas pumps and crumbling weed-choked subdivisions, there are nightmares. And now, someone is on the way to face the nightmares, alone. He can hear the drumbeats of the death parade echoing through the sanctuary. A few minutes ago, the sun sank below the wall. Twilight is approaching, the end of the day, and the end of a life, the traditional time for the police to escort their worst offenders to the execution site, through the gates, beyond the wall, to the altar. Shadows drape the streets, but the last light still flames the tops of the highest buildings. The dome, the home of the mayor, once the Capitol building, glows like a half moon against the paling sky. Simon hurries to the gates, not because he cares who has been sentenced to die, and not because he wants to witness the spectacle of the parade, but because others do. The roads and pathways there will be full of people. Distracted people. Distracted people who won't notice a hand slipping into their purse or pocket. He crosses a wooden bridge that spans a sewage canal. He zigzags through a garden of agave, its serrated leaves biting at his ankles. So tall and prickly pear and date palms and even a few gnarled cherry trees. He pauses briefly to pluck a handful of fruit and pop them into his mouth, before starting on his way again. The cherries are shrunken and bitter, and he sucks on them while darting down an alley busy with trash and rats and lean-tos and a VW minibus that has been converted to a shelter. This leads him to the Central Avenue, a wide, cobblestone thoroughfare jammed with people. Some wear burlap and cotton and wool stitched from fresh materials. Some wear the leftovers of the world before. Hoodies, jerseys, jeans, sneakers, boots. Decayed polyester and threadbare denim patched with leather or plastic squares. Some paint their lips and their eyelids. Some wear necklaces that rattle with teeth and keys and bottle caps. Many are deformed, with shrunken arms or six-fingered hands or ears that look like baby's fists or slitted noses or blind white eyes. Many are tumored and blotched with burns and cancers from the sun. Many of the men have beards, and many of the women long braids with feathers nested in them. Aside from the occasional bright flare of orange or red or yellow, most of what they wear is the color of stone and sand, shades of gray and brown. They all wear hats, and all of their mouths are raw and chapped from lack of water. Simon spits out the cherry stones and joins them. He is short and slender for his age, so he is able to slip through the crush of bodies. He is good at this, sneaking his way through things, his body through buildings, his hands into pockets and drawers. His mousy hair and narrow face make him unnoticeable, forgettable, which suits him perfectly. A jingle cart rolls by, dragged by a man with a mossy beard that reaches his waist. Dust rises in a cloud behind him, the dust that is everywhere. The cart, a welded collection of rusted license plates anchored to two different size wheels, is covered with tiny bells that chime at every rut in the road. The man calls out his wares, medicines and candies, medicines and candies. No one pays him any attention. All eyes are on the procession, worming its way down the avenue. The deputies are dressed in black, broad-rimmed black hats, black shirts with a star on the breast, tucked into black jeans, tucked into black boots with sharp silver tips, their standard uniform. They wear holsters for machetes, not for guns, since all firearms were long ago outlawed in the sanctuary. The first man carries a drum, a yellow hide stretched across a broad, round frame. A skull is painted across its face, and he slams a mallet against it. He walks in rhythm to the beat, every other step intoned by a deep, hollow bong. He is followed by two women with torches, the smoke trailing behind them, threading together in a black cloud that hangs over their prisoner. He is obscured by the smoke and by the crowd. He hunches over, his hair masking his face, his wrists and ankles bound by chains that rattle with his every trudging step. He is followed by two more deputies who shove him along whenever he slows. This is early summer. The day was as hot as an oven, and twilight has brought little relief. Simon tries to breathe through his mouth. The odor of so many unwashed bodies unsettles his stomach. He jostles, trips, tickles, blows in an ear, making people move. And when they move, he takes advantage of their momentum and distraction and filches coins from pockets. Everyone's clothes are coated with dust, so that when they move, little puffs rise off them. A girl watches him sneak a loose ring off a woman's pinky. She is clutching a naked plastic doll with no eyes and half a head of hair. He smiles at her and brings a finger to his lips, and she smiles back and hides behind her father's leg. Everyone peers over each other's shoulders, trying to glimpse the prisoner. The drum sounds. Again, and again, and over its tolling, a voice calls out loudly for them to move aside, move along. The crowd does as the man says, separating and then converging around the deputies once they pass by. The voice belongs to Rickett Slade, their sheriff. He wears the same uniform as his officers. He is a massive man, thick-set, with broad shoulders, a head like a pocked boulder, and hands the size and texture of rough pine planks. His eyes are too close together, and lost beneath baggy folds of flesh. What little hair he has, wringing his head, is as pale and downy as corn silk.
"Make way," he says. "Make way for the dead man who walks."
Simon slips a bracelet off her wrist, unclasps a necklace, some made of gold, some made of plastic, all worth something, even if only a trade at the bazaar, a brick of cheese, a loaf of bread. His pockets are nearly full, and he has pushed his way to the front of the crowd when he looks up and sees the prisoner, really notices him for the first time. The jowly cheeks, the nose and cheeks brightly filamented with capillaries, the same mousy brown hair as his own. It is a face he recognizes. It is a face others in the crowd recognize, several of them whispering his name. Samuel. His father. Simon is familiar with death. It is impossible not to be in the sanctuary. He has witnessed the lashings at the whipping posts. He has dodged the knives that flash in the streets and bars. He has seen his pale-skinned, rib-slatted mother laid out on a slab of stone with her breasts scarred over, both removed, though not in time to stop the tumors bulging like toads from the glands beneath her neck. But that doesn't stop him from feeling a dagger jab of dread. His father is being marched to his death. His father is a drunk, and when he is drunk, he makes loud pronouncements about everything from the unfairness of the rations to the foolishness of their new mayor. He often spirals into dark moods that round his hands into fists, sharpen his words into blades. For this reason, the two of them haven't spoken much over the past year, ever since Simon took to the streets. There was a time when they used to get along, when his father would wrestle with him or tell scary stories or play Billy Joel and Beatles songs on his guitar, when they would work together on the small garden that grew in their windowsill boxes. That was before Simon's mother died, before his father tried to purify his grief with gallons and gallons of tequila. On more than one occasion, after getting slapped across the face, knocked to the ground, or shoved in a closet, Simon wished him dead. Now the wish will come true, and he wishes he could take it back. Beyond the wall, hairless sandwolves roam with eyes as yellow as candle flame. There are giant spiders with trapdoors netted over and dusted with sand. Snakes longer and wider than any man's arm, with fangs that can pierce leather. Big cats with claws that can shred metal like paper. Some say the flu, the cough and fever that brought about the ruin of the world, still hides in the throats of caves, in the closets of old buildings, riding the breeze like the spores of some black flower that will take root in your lungs, though most believe it perished alongside everything else. A ranger once told Simon about a dead deer found in the outlying forest that looked as though it had been peeled open and turned inside out. The same fate he met a few weeks later, his head torn off and his belly emptied and his limbs gnashed down to bones. Beyond the wall, wildness took over. Things with big claws and sacks of poison lay in wait. This, Simon can hear in the voices that tremble with fear and sadistic anticipation, is what awaits his father. People begin to cry out and pull back, mobbing away from the gates, knowing they'll open soon, afraid of what might come hurrying out of the twilight. The sharp, reedy call of a bone whistle precedes the steel arm being lifted from its hangers. The double doors, made from logs reinforced with metal, are heaved open, and the deputies continue into the gloom. They will take his father to the altar in the woods, a stone platform to which he will be chained. Some people linger with ghoulish fascination, while others disperse, off to pursue whatever business remains for them this evening. The farmers in the stables milking heifers, butchering pigs. The tailor shearing sheep and spinning wool into yarn, or treating the hides of animals with chemicals that bleach their hands a cancerous yellow. The tattooists inking designs onto arms and necks and faces. The whores spreading their legs on flea-specked mattresses. The bartenders filling tumblers full of eye-watering, throat-burning liquor. The jingle carts and pharmacists hawking snake poison and medicinal jellies and pills for coughs, kidney stones, genital infections. The vendors in the old warehouse selling clothes, pottery, tools, fruit, charred meat on a stick, whatever scraps the rangers bring back from their excursions beyond the wall. Cracked and faded Happy Meal toys, dented espresso machines, football helmets with rotted out padding, shattered tablets, laptops with sand spilling out of their keyboards. They are eager to return to normalcy, opening a window, tying a shoe, while his father will be torn to pieces. Simon remains fixed in place. His eyes are on the wall, as if it has betrayed him, betrayed his father. There are those whose jobs concern mending and fortifying the wall. That was his father's trade. His arms were crosshatched with cuts, and his hands colored with bruises and caked with cement. He broke his leg once after a fall from the upper reaches of the wall, and he healed oddly so that he seemed to drag himself about more than walk. And now, the man who spent his life repairing and making fast the thing that holds the danger outside is now the man thrust from its safety. The bird perches on the wall. It observes the prisoner hauled away, the crowd scattering, and then with a creaking snap of its wings, it takes flight. It appears to be an owl, though not like any other in the world, made of metal, and only a little larger than a man's fist. Torches flare up all around the sanctuary to fight the intruding night, and the owl's bronze feathers catch the light brightly when it flies from the wall, then over the gardens, the stables, the ropes of smoke that rise from chimneys and forges and ovens, the twisting streets busy with carts and dogs and bodies that stumble out of doorways. The wind blows cinders and dried bits of grass up into dust devils, and the owl blasts through them. The skyscrapers and high-rises needle upward from the center of the sanctuary. Old Town, they call it. And the mechanical owl darts between the canyons of them now. Some of them still have windows, but most are open air, so that they appear like a vast and rotting honeycomb inside which people crouch like brown grubs. The owl's wings whirr. Gears snap and tick beneath its breast. Within its glass eyes, an aperture contracts or expands, depending on whether the owl casts its gaze at light or shadow. The remains of downtown St. Louis have been built over and repurposed to the degree that someone who stepped across the centuries would not recognize one for the other. Everything sunken and leaning and crumbling and patched together in a way that appears accidental. The city covered with a dusty skin, and seeming in this way and many others, a dying thing. Its windows and archways, hollowed eyes, its streets, curving yellowed arteries, its buildings, haggard bones. With its footsteps and hammer strokes and slammed doors, like the beating of an arrhythmic heart. And the many swarming bodies, like black mites feeding on whatever might be scrapped, salvaged. Turbines spike the tops of many buildings. They are made from rescued metal, and they creak and groan and spin rustily in the wind that never stops blowing. They feed into unreliable wiring that snakes through some of the buildings so that lights sputter on and off, and empty sockets burn red and sometimes flare into fires. And the lives of the people here are energized in a similar manner. Frayed and sizzling, capable at any given moment of burning out. The signs are still there. Supercuts, Subway, McDonald's, Curves, Chili's, Chipotle, LensCrafters. Though they are hard to spot, their colored plastic fractured and lichen-spotted and dulled to the yellowy shade of an old man's teeth. What was once a sandwich shop is now a blacksmith and welding studio. From its doorway steps a man who holds a clamp that grips a red-hot square of metal, maybe a door hinge or hoe blade, and he dunks it into a bucket of horse piss and follows the steam trailing upward and through it sees the owl blur overhead like a comet. What was once a salon is now a dentist's office. In the corner, a dryer chair sits like a dead astronaut. The studs grimace through the places where the drywall has rotted away. Near the open window, a dentist peers into a mouth of butter-colored teeth, one of them black. And just when he secures it with his pliers, the owl flashes past his shop and he startles backward with the tooth uprooted and his patient screaming in his chair. On a balcony, an old woman lounges in a threadbare lawn chair that nearly sinks her bottom to the ground. She wears stockings that are wrinkled at the knees and rotted through to reveal her bony ankles. Her feet are stuffed into an ancient pair of laceless Nikes, the soles as hard as concrete. She drinks a foul tea from a dented thermos. Above her hangs a wind chime of old cell phones that clatter in the breeze. When the owl buzzes by her, she shrieks, and the thermos falls 30 feet before clanging and splattering the street below. She knows whom the owl belongs to. They all do. And they fear it as they fear him. The museum, once City Hall, is one of the grandest buildings in the sanctuary, 6 stories high, with a vaulted red slate roof and marble floors and walls made of sandstone. It has the dark-windowed, stained stone grandeur of a haunted mansion. Swallows squawk and scatter where they appear as scratches against the purple-black expanse of sky. The owl skitters to a stop on one of the upper windowsills. It approaches the glass pane and taps its beak. In the street below, a few people pause to point at and whisper about the owl. Magic, some say. Freak, others say. A richly patterned, threadbare rug covers the floor. The walls are hidden behind bookshelves weighed down with leather tomes and yellowed maps carrying the geographies of unexplored worlds and an ancient U.S. flag that bears 17 stars, its red stripes faded to brown, its blues to black. The ceiling is angled with exposed timbers. Despite the heat of the day, a log flames in the fireplace, flanked by 2 stone horses made from onyx. The man, seated at the desk, is always cold. He wears an oversized gray wool cardigan. His hand now gathers the fabric tighter around his neck. This is Lewis Merriweather, the curator. He is clean-shaven, unlike so many men, his milk-pale skin offset by the black hair sprouting stiffly from his head. He looks older than his 33 years, his posture slouched from all his time at his desk, his face long with flattened cheekbones and a nose as sharp as the quill he keeps next to his inkpot. His eyes are blue but red-rimmed. They bulge from all his time spent reading. He has been here all day and was here all of last night. He rarely sleeps, prefers night to day. The sun gives him headaches and burns his fair skin and drags all the people from their beds. He has never been fond of people, and they have never been fond of him. They whisper about him when they pass through the museum, startled from him when he makes a rare appearance. The wizard in the tower, the hermit in the cave. Lanterns are lit throughout the room. The logs smolder in the fireplace like dying suns. His desk is a lacquered red, its sides and legs carved into so many dragons twisting into each other. A map is unrolled before him, weighed down with a teacup, a yellow agate, a chipped plate carrying a black heel of bread, a candle burned down to a blistered nub. Every now and then he stirs a spoon through a bowl of cold corn mash. Otherwise he studies the map with a bone-handled magnifying glass that roams a ring of light across the brittle, yellowed paper. Here are snow-capped mountains, lush forests, rivers as thick and blue as a lizard's tongue, a landscape alien to the one he knows, what lies beyond the wall. His whole life he has spent dreaming of distant worlds. They call to him. And though he might imagine himself elsewhere, he feels safest and most comfortable here, at his desk. A voyeur. His focus is so deep that he does not hear the owl tapping repeatedly at the glass, nor does he hear the door open, the footsteps thudding across the floor. They belong to a muscular girl with short hair, square bangs. This is Ella, his aide. At the edge of his desk, she stacks a tall armful of papers, brittle and torn and tied with twine, mismatched in size and font, some the computer printouts of another time, others the remains of books that have lost their binding. When Lewis does not address her, she says, "What you asked for? From the archives?" He lifts a hand to acknowledge or dismiss her. She makes no move to leave. Her mouth tightens into a bud. He sighs through his nose and sets down the magnifying glass with a click and looks at her with his eyebrows raised in a question he doesn't bother asking. "My hands are paper cut and blistered from the lantern I've been carrying." She holds them up as evidence. "It took 2 hours to find what you wanted. I've been gone 2 hours for 2 hours worth of work. You'd think I deserved a thank you. Wouldn't you think that?" His fingers are as long as knitting needles. They lift the magnifying glass again, but before he peers through it, his eyes settle on the window, where the owl waits. "You may leave now." He spits out his words like chips of ice. She nods at his plate, his bowl. "You haven't eaten." "I said you may leave. Now. Thank you." When the door clicks closed behind her, he rises from his desk and approaches the window. He lifts the latch and holds out his arm for the owl to climb upon. He can hear the ticking of its cogged wheels, the creaking twist of its knobs and gears, beneath which he detects a grinding that might be dust, the dust that creeps into everything. Later, he will have to unscrew the owl, brush it out, wipe clean, and oil its guts. But first, he draws the curtains. The room falls into deeper shadow. He holds up his arm, as if to send the owl into flight. Instead, it goes rigid. Something clicks and snaps inside it. Its eyes glow, circles of light. A milky projection spills quaveringly across the wall. Without expression, he studies the march of the death parade, the crowd of people surrounding it, until the owl's eyes dim, and the projection sputters off and leaves him in darkness. Simon hates what his father has become, but he doesn't hate him. They share good memories. They share a complicated love. They share the same blood, and this is what compels him to do what he does next. He brags that he knows his way around any door and into any room in the sanctuary. The new mayor talks often about how everyone needs to do their part, now more than ever, contribute to the common good, specialize in a trade. And Simon likes to think that this is his role. He is a thief, the very best of thieves, light-fingered and considerate. He doesn't hurt anyone, not like some brute in an alleyway, and he never leaves behind a mess, splintering a door, upending a drawer, never takes more than needs to be taken, redistributing wealth. But what he never brags about, what he never tells anyone, is that not only can he sneak his way into any corner of the sanctuary, he can also sneak out. His father is the one who told him about the sewers, the many tunnels that run beneath the ground, all of the entries cemented over, for safety, it was said, so that nothing could get in.
"And so that no one, not a one of us, can get out of this reeking pit," his father said.
He was always saying things like this, calling the sanctuary a prison, the politicians its wardens. It was in the museum that Simon found the passage. He liked to go there sometimes, after hours, when no one could follow him around and yell at him for getting too close, for touching the artwork and artifacts. He liked to touch, but he never stole from the one place that belonged to everyone. Late at night, he would crawl through a window and wander the many long, high-ceilinged rooms and put his face right up to the paintings, run his fingers along the brushstrokes. He would duck under the ropes to an exhibit, petting the scaled spine of an alligator, clacking his fingers across the keyboard of a dead-eyed computer. climbing into the Toyota on display to twist its many knobs and wrap his hands around the steering wheel. One time, he fell asleep inside a covered wagon exhibit. People said Lewis, the thin, strange man Simon saw sometimes at a distance, kept company with the devil. They said he studied black magic. They said he knew everything that ever happened and would happen. They said nothing escaped his notice in the sanctuary. The owl was one of many spies, the rats and bats and cockroaches also in his service. Simon did not believe them enough to stay away from the museum, but he believed them enough to stay away from his quarters on the upper level. He looked often over his shoulder and one time startled at the sight of a lantern floating down the staircase, a figure descending and speaking softly, maybe talking to himself or maybe uttering some incantation. Simon ran then, bolted down to the basement, a vast storage area filled with wooden boxes, draped paintings, dust-cloaked specimens. He hid there for hours. A faint dripping caught his attention, and he found in the floor a grate, and beyond the grate, a metal ladder that descended into darkness. It was several weeks before he gained the courage to return and wander the tunnels below. And several weeks more before he discovered another grate with moonlight coursing through it. He climbed up to find himself outside the sanctuary, along some ruined street where houses and storefronts had collapsed upon themselves and trees rose through blisters in the asphalt. He outsourced his thieving then, as if he was a ranger. From buildings and cars, he pirated metals, plastics, leathers, to then pawn to vendors at the bazaar. If anyone ever asked where he came upon such a thing, a toaster, a phone, a trumpet, DVDs, a plastic tote full of eyeliner and brick-hard foundation, things that often had no value outside of curiosity, he would say he found it. That's all. He found it. Just as he now finds his father, chained and kneeling at the altar. Simon has been here before, what he believes to be some sort of town square, the altar at its center once a fountain, with the crumbled faces of children as spouts. The stone is painted with the blood of those chained here before his father. At first, Simon thinks it is too late. His father's skin appears gray and waxen in the moonlight, his head hangs low. Then Simon sees his chest rise and fall, hears a wheeze. He is sleeping, or weeping. Weeping, Simon discovers, when he climbs the altar, and his father raises his head and widens his damp eyes and says,
Simon, no, what are you doing?
What does it look like? I'm here to save you.
You shouldn't. You can't.
There is no venom in his voice, none of the nastiness that made Simon leave him, just exhaustion, sadness. Worry. His father continues to protest as Simon examines his wrists, assessing the locks that hold him in place so tightly that his fingers are cold and lifeless. Simon keeps a thin knife with a hooked tip at his belt. He uses it now to pick at one of the keyholes at his father's wrist, prodding and twisting, feeling for the lever, listening for the click. He is well practiced at this, but it still takes a long 3 minutes before the one hand, his right hand, falls free. His father's wrist is bloodied, and he cries out briefly at the cramps racking him. Then he throws an arm around his son. Simon struggles against him, but his father has always been a big man and has put on even more weight from his drinking. Simon heaves, but his father clings to him. Not fighting him, the boy comes to realize, but hugging him.
Dad, quit it. There's no time for this.
Shh. It's too late, son.
What do you mean?
Can't you hear?
Both their bodies still for a moment. Then his father leans in, his mouth at Simon's ear so that the whisper sounds like a shout.
Do you hear it?
Simon listens. The adrenaline coursing through him creates a barely traceable hum at the edge of his hearing. At first, that is the only sound. He studies the black buildings and the black trees and the blacker shadows between them. The wind rises and falls, as if the night is breathing. the branches murmur. Then comes a snap, a stick underfoot. Gravel crunches. Something is coming. No, not one thing, but many, he realizes, as more sounds crackle and whisper and thud out in the darkness. Simon brings the knife to his father's other wrist and hurriedly stabs at the lock. His father knocks away the knife. You need to go, he says, and then, please, son. The desperate kindness in his voice is impossible to ignore. Please, go, now. Simon wants to stay. He wants to fight, but his father pushes him, and he stumbles away from the altar just as something humpbacked and four-legged creeps into the square. The moon has sunk from sight, the night now lit by stars alone, and he cannot make out anything more than that, a hunched darkness, as if the night has congealed into a figure. Go, his father says, and Simon finally listens, hurrying away as a second and then third creature join the first.
Here I am,
his father is yelling.
Over here!
Rattling the chains and whooping, making as much noise as possible to distract from Simon's escape. The yelling soon gives way to screaming. Simon runs. He cannot stop the tears that make the spaces between stars blur and the sky appear to gloss over with a phantasm. Chapter 2. This morning, as the sun rises and reddens the world so that it appears it might catch flame, Clark stands at her sentry post atop the wall. Around it reaches a burn zone of some 70 yards. Beyond this grows a forest, with many broken buildings rising from it, black-windowed, leaning messes of skeletal steel and shattered stone. The remains of the St. Louis Arch, collapsed in the middle, appear like a ragged set of mandibles rising out of the earth. In the near distance, where once the Mississippi flowed, stretches a blonde wash of sand. Somewhere out there, hidden from view, hide yammering sandwolves, cat-sized spiders, droves of javelinas with tusks longer than her fingers. These are the dangers that find those chained to the altar. 20 minutes ago, the deputies departed the sanctuary, and they return now with a stretcher bearing the body of a man, the man from last night's death parade. His face is unrecognizable, hidden beneath a seething mask of flies. His body is shredded or chewed to bone in most places. His belly is split open, and his entrails dangle from him like red ropes. For as long as she can remember, this has been the punishment doled out to those who committed rape or murder. But now, they have a new mayor, and with a new mayor come new policies. He has made it treason to complain about the rations, to so much as speak ill of his administration. He wants them to know his ears are always listening, his eyes always watching. Now this body, this so-called traitor, will be paraded through the streets, an example for everyone. These are difficult times, with their water running dry, and difficult times call for unforgiving measures. Everyone has a job, the mayor says. That job is to serve the sanctuary. They are all part of the same organism, and if anyone does anything to threaten it, they will be excised like the melanomas that stain the skin of so many. The gates open and close behind the deputies. Clark walks to the edge of the wall and balances precipitously there. She imagines what it would feel like to slip, to fall, the wind roaring in her ears, the ground rushing toward her face. Join the fate of the man. He, after all, believed what she believes. He said aloud the same things she keeps caged inside her. For her to call this place home, to feel not sheltered but imprisoned, and do nothing? It's too much. That's why last night, after the death parade, she drank herself into oblivion. She tried to hurry past the bar. Then she heard the laughter spilling out of it, and she paused in the wedge of lamplight that fell from its doorway into the street. She could see through the ribcage doors, beyond the swell of bodies, a man on stage, plucking a guitar and stomping his foot and singing Paint It Black. And she gave in to the excuse that she would stop in for one good song, one strong drink. She had promised she wouldn't, but her mood was foul, and the night was hot, and she was so thirsty. Her name is Wilhelmina, a family name, a name she despises, a weak, perfumed, lacy thing she can tolerate only if shortened to Mina. But mostly she goes by her last name, Clark. Depending on the light, her hair appears red or blonde, same as the sand. With a knotted strip of leather, she keeps it tied back into a short tail. Her face is hawkish, her eyes always narrowed, and her mouth always tightened as if tied at the corners by knots. Though the bars serve other liquor, gin, vodka, whatever else is in the well, some hooch that goes down like snake venom, people drink mostly whiskey and mezcal and sotol and tequila. And that was what she was drinking last night. Tequila. The liquor was distilled in better times, when water ran more freely, aged now to potency and costing too much coin. The floor was wood shavings, the stools were old tires, and the ceiling scrap metal welded carelessly so that through its many holes she could see the stars spinning above like the ringworms in her glass. People hurled feathered darts. They huddled together in card games with mismatched decks. They played pool with leather-tipped steel rods and rocks ground and polished into balls. The warmth of the liquor raced to her fingertips, pulsed at her temples, and before long, she was burning inside like the cigarillo pinched between her lips, burning like the candle she held her elbow over too long on a bet, burning like the pain in her hand when she broke the nose of the bartender who asked her to leave, told her she had had enough. She had had enough, all right. This morning, she can feel her heartbeat in her forehead, like a door slammed over and over again. She wears a wide-rimmed hat and shaded goggles, but still, the sun seems too bright when she stares off into the ruined wilderness that reaches to the horizon, where sometimes she believes mountains are visible, though no one else will say so. They claim she is seeing what she wants to see. They claim it is a mirage, a trembling image brought on by the heat, like some hellish counterpart to her wall, spiny and manned by the spirits of dead giants. She takes a pull of her canteen to try to fight the cottonmouth, but her body barely lets her swallow. The wind gusts. It sighs. It whistles through the many hollows of the wall in which swallows and wasps nest. It carries sand in it that stings skin and eats holes in cloth and dulls the edge of a blade. It nearly knocks her from the edge, and she wobbles back onto the landing. The sanctuary reaches across a mile in some places, a half mile in others. The wall is not a circle or a square. It is shapeless, an improvisation that became a permanent corral. She is a sentinel. She rotates in her duties, either scavenging outside the wall as a ranger or patrolling its perimeter on sentry. Every sentry is assigned a 200-yard section of the wall marked by iron braziers filled with wood, with torches lit beside them. If any threat emerges from the forest, whether man or beast, they are to hurl the torch upon the brazier as a flaming alarm. Her uniform is not the night black of the deputies, but gray and brown, as though mended from stone and wood. Her job is to stare out at a fractal landscape of umber and dust and ruins, guarding against whatever awaits them in the Deadlands. She does not answer to the sheriff. She does not serve as an enforcer. She does not hurt others, only protects. But still, her job feels like a betrayal of conscience, since she patrols the very wall she believes they need to escape, no matter the risk. Better to seek out life than wait for death in this dried-out fishbowl. She used to loudly debate this with others at the bars. These days, sharing such an opinion will only get her killed. But she is right. She knows she is right. There were 8 wells in the sanctuary, all of them broad-mouthed pipes with metal ladders built down their throats. 3 of them have collapsed. their casing pinched off and deemed impossible to repair due to some shifting beneath the earth. Another has gone dry. The remaining four are guarded by deputies who regulate the long lines, the people who come dragging jugs for their daily ration. A wind turbine lifts the water and shoots it from a spigot. The motor sits directly over the well, grinding away and dusting the water with rust and turning the impellers that reach deep into the aquifer beneath them. The water used to come in a minerally gush. These days the spigots dribble and sputter. The mayor says he is meeting with workmen who might worm their way down and extend the pipes, dig deeper, find the cold, good water that must be waiting to be tapped beneath their feet. People are worried. Buckets and barrels and leather bags hang from every corner of the city to capture any rainwater. And a network of canals funnel water and sewage to their meager crops. But the clouds have not gathered and burst in more than 3 months. The standard of the past few years. The stretches between downpours longer and longer. People boil their urine for drinking water. They sleep below tarps that gather moisture from their breathing and channel it into a pot. They ration out the stores they keep in buckets and barrels. They drink the blood of bats and rats and birds. This is not a sustainable existence. The sanctuary slowly knuckling in on itself, like a dried date. Below, Clark can hear the sentinels gathering into a ranging party. The stamping and snorting of horses, the creaking of leather, the clinking of spurs, the shifting of arrows in their quivers. The sun rises high enough to crest the wall, and in a rush, last night's shadows retreat, and the windows flash and the canals brighten into many diamond points. The sun, the cruel orange eye that cooks the sweat from their skin, and the water from the ground and the clouds from the sky. The temperature in the sanctuary immediately spikes 15 degrees. The space beneath the gates, though, remains a pocket of shadow, and it is here that the riders gather. The bone whistle sounds, the gates groan open, and the rangers ride out 2 horses abreast. They all wear hats to battle the sun and neckerchiefs to battle the dust. At their lead is Reed, the chief of the sentinels. Even from here, she can see the long black braid twisting down his back like a shorn noose. She wills him to turn in his saddle and look for her, but he does not. She imagines she can feel his disappointment radiating off him. Earlier, when she stumbled out of her quarters and reported to the stables, he took her face in his hands and shook his head and told her to climb the wall. She was in no shape to ride, still drunk from the night before. A great wing of dust rises behind them, and the wind carries it toward her, the grit pattering her clothes, biting her face when she watches them depart. It will be another week, she's guessing, before he allows her to rotate back from sentry to ranger. He disapproves of her drinking not only because of the hazard to her body, the interference with her duties, but because he cannot risk her speaking loosely to others. The risk is too great, given their plans. She doesn't know when they will leave, where they will go, or how they will get there. But she will not die here. She will escape. She understands why Reed punishes her. But she hates him for it. Because she hates the wall. She prefers to move, to escape, ride at a gallop with the reins wrapped around her fist and the wind knocking her hair. Fire a whistling arrow into a buck's breast. Collect jackrabbits and coyotes from her many traps, fill satchels with juniper berries for the distilleries, salvage steel and copper from buildings as dark as tombs, kick through the skeletons that lie everywhere and rip the drawers out of dressers, pull open cabinets, upend toolboxes, dig through closets. By comparison, the wall is stillness. The wall is control. The wall is imprisonment that she finds maddening. There is much she finds maddening. As a child, she bit her grandfather when he wouldn't give her another one of the salted nuts they ate for dessert. After being teased and tripped by a group of boys, she picked up a fist-sized stone and knocked the teeth from one of them. She kicked the leg of a table and sent supper crashing to the floor. She dropped a beetle in her baby brother York's mouth when, as an infant, he wouldn't stop crying. Not much has changed. Her whole life, she has been told this is her greatest weakness, her inability to control herself. She tries, but whenever she is provoked, like a bee's nest disturbed, something swarms out of her, something out of her control, making her capable of anything, of escaping.